What if Jesus was serious when he said these words? I mean, it's one of the most influential, powerful messages ever shared on planet Earth. And I can tell you, it actually changed my life. If you're here and you follow Jesus, our hope is during this series, you'll discover what it's like to actually live the way of Jesus. And if you're here and you're just exploring God, our hope is that you'll see that what you see on the news, that hypocritical, judgmental, overly politicized version of churchianity, is far different than what Jesus describes here. See, this message is actually transformative when we learn to apply it and live it out. Before I began to take Jesus seriously, I would consider myself more of a cultural Christian. I said I believed on Sunday, but I lived very differently on Saturday night. Maybe that's been your story. Maybe that is your story even now. So when I was in college, I began to really try to follow Jesus, and I took Jesus at his word so seriously that I actually memorized Matthew 5, 6, and 7, three chapters in the Bible. I don't know if I could even memorize three verses now. But I not only memorized it, I asked God to help me try to live it out. And so you can imagine how excited I was when years later, my daughter and I got to be part of the filming of the Sermon on the Mount for the TV show, The Chosen. And actually, it was a really amazing experience. Here's a picture of me that day. Don't I look like I'm ancient? Here's Trevi. And then this is also Trevi. It was the Wednesday before the icepocalypse. It was 20 degrees. It was in the height of COVID. You can see the crowd wearing masks and coats. It was terribly cold. Here's me frozen. Those are icicles on my eyebrows, not gray hairs. Some people think it's gray hairs. It's icicles. And even the actor playing Jesus was wearing a coat. It was incredibly cold. But here's the video of the crowd. There's actually a little... It goes up close, and you can see the red circle. We're to the right of it. See us there in the black turban, the green? Trevi is trying to sit down as slow as humanly possible in that moment. So would you like to see our big screen premiere? All right, here's the scene from The Chosen. Here it is. To the left of center, right over there, slowly sitting down. There she is, last one seated. That's right. I love this look Jesus gives the crowd. There it is. Now, yes, thank you. Now, if you have not watched The Chosen, I highly recommend you do. It's really a well-told version of the story of Jesus and those who follow him. It's now so accessible, the first season's on Netflix. It's actually from Angel Studios, the same production company that is actually got a new film coming out this weekend called After Death, featuring John Burke, our very own John Burke. And actually, Trevi and I are at the last scene of season two, the first scene of season three, so you can say we're in two seasons of The Chosen. We're almost as famous as John Burke now. But I want you to put yourself in that crowd. On that day, that cold day, I had a chance to pretend that I was in the crowd 2,000 years ago. I mean, imagine if you were there hearing these words where Jesus was saying things that were blowing your mind and convicting your heart. How would you respond? In this series, we've discovered in week one that Haley reminded us that everyone is welcome in this kingdom. And then last week, Ricky Etchiona described how as members of this kingdom, we're to be light and salt. We're to be people who help others find this loving God. And today, we're talking about how do we actually pull that off. This morning, the big idea is if Jesus was serious about heart transformation, then our thoughts, motives, and intentions are deeply significant. See, Jesus begins to unpack this transformation by using some of the Ten Commandments and real life scenarios to poke and prod and bring God's restoration to the human condition. And just before the passage we heard read today was a line where Jesus said that our righteousness needs to be even greater than the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. He's being sarcastic. These religious leaders were hypocrites. They said all the right thing, but in their hearts, there was anger and contempt, lust and dishonesty. Jesus is inviting us to be transformed from the inside out. And if you missed any of the messages in this series, I want to encourage you to come up with a new habit. If you have to miss on a Sunday, go back and listen or watch on our website or on our YouTube channel. Stay connected with what we're doing, because each of these is a message that builds on the message that Jesus has for us. And today we're looking at these little vignettes where Jesus uses a popular rabbinic refrain, "You have heard it said." He's taking these Old Testament laws or principles that everyone in that crowd would have been familiar with, and he's giving them a new perspective on it. See, today we're looking at what Jesus says about anger and sexual lust and honesty. Three important issues that could destroy us if we go down that path. Now, I just so happen to get the section of the sermon that people have the most difficult time taking Jesus at his word. His interpretation of these commands makes following him seem unrealistic or impossible. But you have to remember, he's not talking about perfection. He's talking about the progress of the heart. And we could spend an entire series on each of these, and we have in the past. But I want to encourage you during this series to spend time reading Matthew 5, 6, and 7, just over and over throughout the series, and really let it saturate your heart and mind, and really ask God to help you live it out. And you'll begin to notice that God cares so much more for our thoughts and our heart than just our words and our actions. Remember, the goal of this message Jesus is proclaiming is that the kingdom of heaven is here. And if you want to follow me, the king, this is what life is like. So first, if Jesus was serious, then anger left unchecked is more destructive than we realized. Verse 21, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment.' But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, 'Raka,' is answerable to the court. And anyone says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you're still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you've paid the last penny." Let's look at a few of these phrases, dive a little bit deeper. You shall not murder. Jesus is quoting Exodus 20, 13, one of the most well-known of the Ten Commandments. But what he's doing is he's saying it's so much more than that. He's zooming in on the spiritual molecular level. He's looking at anger. He's saying you should not murder, but you shouldn't even murder someone in your heart. In fact, you should be reconciled with that person. Do you see the progression in his argument? And then he says that if you say the word raka, which is literally a four-letter word in Jesus's Aramaic language, it means worthless. The equivalent for us is when you're upset with someone and you look at them and you say and mean, "You're an idiot." You are seeing that person with contempt. And when we do that, Jesus says that you're in danger of the fire of hell. Now, when you and I hear hell, that there's a lot of baggage. It could be baggage you have growing up in the church that you grew up in, or maybe just being in this culture, there's all sorts of misunderstandings. We think of Dante's Inferno or a Red Devil and Pitchfork or horror movies, Halloween. But hell is actually the Greek word Gehenna, or the Valley of Gehinnom, where centuries prior, an evil king Ahaz, in one of the worst moments in the history of Israel, took his children, along with many others following along in his lead, and they sacrificed their children to the god Baal. It was in that valley. That valley had become synonymous with evil. And in Jesus' day, that valley had turned into a trash heap that was constantly smoldering and burning. Now, we're not explaining away hell. Throughout the Gospels, Jesus describes a place where those who do not want to be with God will exist without God. We don't have time to unpack the message of hell today, but let me just say that there's a lot of misunderstanding that we can clear up if we actually look at what the scriptures say. Or you can even pick up Imagine Heaven, right? John's book, which, by the way, the new book is coming out this week. And John will be here next week for the first time in 6 months. You'll get to hear from John Burke. I want you to invite people to come. Invite people to watch online. He's not talking about hell next week, by the way. He's talking about heaven. And if you pre-purchase the book, you're actually helping others discover that God has something so much more beautiful for all of us. We're all invited. But back to hell. This valley was a metaphor, a word picture for how evil can reach a boiling point of judgment. And often God's judgment is actually letting us have what we want. It's when he removes his hand of protection and gives us what we continue to demand. Jesus is saying, you're in danger of the fire of hell. He's not talking about later. He's talking about right now. That if we have anger in our heart that's not dealt with, that's not repented from, that it actually can burn us up from the inside. Can destroy our view of other people, destroy our relationships. It will be hell on earth if we don't deal with our anger. Verse 23, Jesus continues, therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them. Then come and offer your gift. Jesus is teaching in Galilee and the temple was quite a ways away, and he's using an extreme example, saying if you make it all the way down to the temple to offer your sacrifice, and there remember that there's someone who's been hurt by you, it's more important to go back and make things right with that person. See, Jesus is saying that God is not concerned with our religious rituals or our lip service or our labels. He's concerned with our hearts. If you've wronged someone, you need to make it right. See, resentment in our heart actually blocks our relationship with God. It affects our relationship with him. See, God sees what we often don't, that anger unchecked can lead to contempt, where we no longer see the other person as created in the image of God, but they practically become invisible. Author Dallas Willard said it this way, in anger, I want to hurt you. In contempt, I don't care whether you are hurt or not. Or at least so I say. You're not worthy of consideration one way or the other. We can be angry at someone without denying their worth, but contempt makes it easier for us to hurt them or see them further degraded. If you've ever said something like, I don't resent them, I honestly don't think of them, it's as if you're saying they could either live or die, it's all the same to you. You're in the danger zone of contempt, where anger has become septic and you no longer see people as made in the image of God, but rather as invisible nothings that you are better than. Jesus is warning us, and we harden our hearts towards one person. It not only affects our relationship with him, it actually affects us and our relationships with others. See, no one is invisible to God. No one is unworthy of his attention and love. In verses 25 and 26, Jesus then uses a Gentile scenario of debt imprisonment to tell his listeners how important it is to work out their issues. If you feel stuck in your spiritual walk right now, it'd be good to take a little inventory. Is there any bitterness in your heart towards someone? Is there anyone with whom you need to make amends, towards whom you're harboring anger? Maybe you've just swept things under the rug. Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers, not the peace fakers. Too often we put a smile on our face, but underneath there's a rumbling, like a inferno that's about to explode. See, Jesus says that we can experience reconciliation, that we can step into the conflict. The world usually takes someone with whom we disagree or that's hurt us, and we turn them into the enemy, and we tell everyone around us how terrible they are. But Jesus is saying, no, you could actually make things right with that person, that you could be in relationship with that person, maybe even be closer to that person than you've ever been before. There's a beautiful verse in Romans 12 that says, if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Not just with the people you like or the people that vote the same as you or look the same as you or agree with you, everyone. We have the responsibility to make peace with everyone as far as it depends on us. To ensure we live out our lives as peacemakers, Jesus gives us two different, seemingly contradictory commands. In Matthew 5, he's saying, if you've offended someone, make sure and go make things right. Well, in Matthew 18, he says, if you've been offended by someone, you need to go and make sure things are okay between you. So which is it? Is it the person who's done the offending or the person who's offended that should make things right? Is Jesus confused? I think Jesus knows us well enough to know that neither one of us are going to want to make things right. But maybe if just one of us, either the one who's done the offending or the one who's been offended, if one of us follows the way of Jesus, we're actually moving towards a path of healing. And notice what Jesus says is that you're supposed to go to be with that person face to face to talk through what happened. You're not supposed to talk with other people about what happened. You first take those feelings, and if you're not sure if you've been offended or if it's worth having the conversation, if you keep thinking about it or it triggers you every time you think about it or you can't seem to sleep at night thinking about it, then take those emotions and those thoughts to Jesus. And that might bring a lot of healing and might right-size your thinking, but it might also be that he will send you to that person, not to a committee of others to band together with you against that person, but to go to that person. And you will be amazed at how often it was just a big, giant misunderstanding. You're giving them a chance to apologize, to learn from their mistake. See, Jesus is saying that we can overcome anger in our heart and avoid the actions which might bring pain and destruction to our relationships. We may not struggle with actually killing someone, but how many times have we killed relationships, allowing that bitterness to boil? That's not the way of Jesus. Well, second, we also discover in this message that Jesus was serious when talking about sexual brokenness and familial brokenness, because it starts in the mind and heart. Verse 27, you've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Jesus is bringing up a couple of commandments here. You shall not commit adultery and you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Now, in Jesus' time, many Jewish sources warned against lust and emphasized women's seductiveness. But Jesus was actually here emphasizing the responsibility of lust is laid on the one lusting, in this case, the men. And we know that in today's world, it can go both ways. But Jesus, in his teaching 2,000 years ago, is giving men they're talking to. He's saying to them and to us that so much of sexual brokenness, abuse, and objectification of women begins with the way that men tend to view women, reducing them to sexual objects. He doesn't say blame women or blame culture. He says look at the mirror in the mirror and deal with your lust. By the way, if you didn't like the topic of anger, you're really not gonna like the topic of lust. If we're not careful, we can start to check out. We can think, well, this is impossible. This is unrealistic or just idealistic. See, what Jesus is doing is he's dealing with the core human experiences and bringing rightness or righteousness to them. Now, the Bible has a lot to say on the beauty of sex in the context of marriage. It has a lot to say on the beauty of love. There's an entire book about it called The Song of Solomon. And Jesus is not downing sexual desire. He's actually bringing guardrails to it. He's not just talking about the physical and physiological reaction that happens when we see someone who's attractive. He's not attacking attraction. Attraction is not a sin. Jesus is dealing with what happens after. He's talking about that second look, the thoughts, the fantasies that develop in your mind and heart. What Jesus is talking about is not just the lust. It's not just about the look. It's about the intention behind the look. Looking with the intent to see that person as an object to fulfill your fantasies, or objectifying that person, looking at their body and not looking at the person. Jesus would state clearly today that pornography is in all forms destructive to society. It's destructive to our mental, relational, and sexual health. It makes us dehumanize each other as objects of self-gratification instead of seeing others as the beautiful image bearers of God, as God intended. When we indulge in this, we dehumanize the other person. But we don't want to fall into the other extreme when we demonize the other person, where men, out of fear of lusting, don't even look at women or think women are the trouble, or women feel dehumanized or like they are the enemy, the ones that cause all the trouble. See, we need to right-size the narrative. It's not about looking at people. It's about seeing people through the lens of their creator, at those who have dignity and value. And Jesus is saying, if you can win the battle in your mind, you will not fall emotionally or physically. I've had far too many conversations with too many people who never expected to have an affair or to have an emotional affair or to spend time watching pornography. But it all began with a lingering, lustful glance. Which, by the way, there are TV shows and movies that are way too accessible, that are way more pornographic than we realize. We need to trust Jesus at his word. As I mentioned, this Sermon on the Mount changed my life, and it was this part of the passage in particular that I saw incredible transformation. I was inspired by this passage to begin taking my thoughts captive, to honor God with my mind. And if you grew up in America, you've grown up in a hyper-sexualized world, a world in which, for some reason, sex has been equated with love, and happiness is found in another person. These are all unhealthy ways to view the world. And so as a single guy looking to find the right person, it could have been easy for me to slip into finding someone to meet my needs instead of finding someone that shares the same mission that I could serve and serve with. Someone that I could actually learn to love unconditionally. And so here's what I would do. Anytime I'd see a beautiful woman when I was in college, and by the way, they were everywhere. I went to college in Texas. And so anytime I'd see a beautiful woman, I would, and if I was tempted to have a second glance, I would stop and I would pray a blessing on the young woman. And I would pray for my future wife, whoever she might be. And I would ask God to help me become a man who honors other people the way a true man would. And I would quote Matthew 5:8, which says, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God." And I saw it as a promise from God that if in that one moment of selfishness, if I could take that thought captive, then God would allow me to experience more of who he is. By the way, one of the best ways to get out of a lustful mood is to pray. It's to quote the scriptures. It definitely right-sizes everything in that moment. And without fully knowing what I was doing, this was actually helping me learn to uphold the dignity and humanity of the young woman instead of going down the road of objectification. So back to the hillside with Jesus. Imagine being on the hill and hearing Jesus say these words. Verse 29, "If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell." Can you imagine being the first people on the planet to hear this? I mean, just like in this crowd today, no one is looking to the right or left. Everyone is just looking straight ahead. Jesus, what are you talking about here? See, Jesus is once again using hyperbole to make his point. He's not advocating self-mutilation or even hurting yourself with shame. He's saying, deal with your issues now before they destroy you. See, everyone can fall victim to this. That's why the Apostle Paul, who planted a church, was writing those he had led to faith and explaining how to live in a way that honors God in an over-sexualized world. He says this in 1 Corinthians 6:18, "Flee from sexual immorality. All other sins a person commits are outside the body, but whoever sins sexually sins against their own body." Just run away. Stay away. Don't be in a position to be tempted. And when you're tempted, choose the right path before you bring hell on earth for yourself or for others. You know, so many memoirs are coming out from famous people sharing about their sexual exploits. And the underlying message is how many times their hearts have been broken, something that could have been avoided. And you may be here and you have some regrets and you have some shame. You have some decisions that you wished you had not made. I want you to know that you can start afresh today. Choose to honor your body and to honor others' bodies, and it will actually help protect your heart. See, Jesus is saying this battle begins in the mind. And anyone who has dealt with the effects of promiscuity or sexual abuse or addiction can tell you it is hell. Which is a nice transition into the next topic of divorce. Speaking of hell on earth, if you've been through a divorce, it's one of the most painful experiences you could have. And once again, Jesus is trying to protect us. He says this in verse 31, "It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality makes her the victim of adultery. And anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery." See, too often this verse has been used as a prescription for when divorce is okay. Often we come to the Bible with, what can I get away with? But Jesus was actually describing a rampant, unfair divorce issue in that culture. See, in that day, only the men had the power to issue a divorce. And actually, the rabbis over centuries had come up with a list of all the reasons it's okay to get divorced. And no joke, one of them was a man could divorce his wife if he did not like her cooking. So Jesus is speaking right into that. He's going after the men once again. This is a great example of how Jesus is seeking to protect and provide for women who, if they were divorced, had no other means to provide for themselves. He's protecting those who are oppressed and overlooked. But in our society, it's important for both men and women to take this seriously. He's saying that other than in extreme cases where the other partner has already irreparably broken the marriage covenant, then don't let your heart go there. He's saying to his followers, don't be so flippant with another human life that you would so quickly discard them and move on. He's basically saying, you're already guilty of cheating with how quickly you are to give up. See, Jesus saw 2,000 years ago what sociology and psychology tell us today, that divorce is incredibly painful, that there are scars and ramifications, economic, emotional, and spiritual. And he's warning us, brokenness hurts, and there is a path out. There is a way out. Finally, Jesus was serious. Then the followers of Jesus must choose integrity in our words. Verse 33. Again, you heard it. It was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. Even if you don't have hair, do not swear. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. See, in that day, there was a practice of making an oath and swearing on behalf of a witness deity, a god, swearing by the gods. And Jesus is saying, don't do anything like that. Everything that God has created belongs to him. Just say yes or say no. Ecclesiastes 5 says it like this: it is better not to make a vow than to make one and not fulfill it. See, if Jesus was serious about heart transformation, then our thoughts, motives, and intentions are deeply significant. When I was in Los Angeles, I was at a breakfast, and our pastor was kind of sharing the vision of our church to potential leaders and inviting them to help resource our efforts. And there was a man there, and he asked the question, well, is this a grace church or a law church? And Irwin said, well, this is a grace church. See, the law says do not murder, but grace says you shouldn't even have anger in your heart. The law said do not commit adultery, but grace says you shouldn't even have lust in your heart. The law says give 10%, but grace says you can give 15, 20, 30, 40, 50%. Because grace is never less than the law. I love that idea. Grace is never less than the law. See, what Jesus is doing is he's inviting you and me to be restored to being fully human. We were created in the image of God with the capacity to be more generous, more compassionate, more integrated versions of humanity than how we often live out our lives. We don't have to give in to the division or anger or lust or brokenness or dishonesty, that we can actually arise above and with God's help, out of gratitude for all he's done for us, live new lives. We can become the light, that city on a hill, if we start to live so differently. See, all of us created in the image of God, but we've all chosen to go our own way. And the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus calling us back to our original design. So let me ask you, if you were sitting there listening to Jesus, would you have felt, this is impossible? What Jesus is asking us to do is impossible. How does he expect us to pull that off? Well, the beauty is, that's the point. We cannot live the kind of life we were created to live without his help. That we can experience forgiveness and the power to actually live this out when we surrender our lives to follow him. And it's not just a one time forevermore, but every day surrendering our hearts, our lives. Let him change you from the inside out. We can represent Jesus well. We can walk and live as image bearers. If our city saw us as people who follow Jesus, and they may not understand our beliefs, but they are amazed by how quick we are to forgive, how quick we are to make things right, how honest we are, how honoring of others we are, they would see something different in us and want that too. So if you felt any sort of shame or guilt or regret today, remember, grace is greater than the law. God loves you unconditionally, and he can remove that guilt and shame. Just ask him to forgive you. If Jesus were here today, perhaps he'd say something like this. You've heard it said that you are condemned, but I tell you that grace and mercy flows from the cross in abundance. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, would you speak to us in this moment? God, would you help us to ask you to surrender? Help us surrender. Help us to come before you with any regrets, any shame, that you would make us clean again. God, guide us. May we become people who are known for our love, our ability to honor others, our honesty. God, show us our next steps to grow, to serve, to heal, to help others belong. We pray this in Jesus' name.